What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation. Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report. I would have to say that I am really excited about today's show. You likely have heard of BYOD, Bring Your Own Device, but have you heard of BYOC, Bring Your Own Cloud? Also, have you heard of the Honeybaked Ham case out of the District of Colorado? My guest today will talk about how a trailblazing 2012 judicial opinion could set a new paradigm for BYOD discovery. Not only do we have an electrifying topic today, our guests are e-discovery, information security, and data breach gurus. Alan Brill is the Senior Managing Director for Kroll Advisory Solutions, where he consults on high-tech investigative issues. Alan is an internationally recognized writer, speaker, and instructor on technology security. And if you follow this area of legal technology closely, you will have seen Alan on 60 Minutes, Dateline, Good Morning America, and in Time Magazine and USA Today, among numerous other places. Chris Wall is a senior director at Kroll On Track, where he leverages his deep expertise in information review management to help clients reduce cost and increase accuracy in e-discovery. Chris is a noted expert in antitrust e-discovery issues and a former practicing attorney in Washington, D.C., where he litigated in defense of mergers and acquisitions before the Federal Trade Commission and the Department of Justice. Alan and Chris, so happy you could join me today.
Hey, Michelle. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. It's great to be here.
So, Alan, maybe we could start with you to get us kicked off here on the topic. Start out with some basic definitions. BYOD, BYOC, what are they and why should legal professionals care?
For companies to allow employees to do company work on a personally owned device. Now, sometimes the company imposes a set of rules, and they even install software on the device, creating what technical people call a sandbox, within which the business part of the email or documents exist. But sometimes there are very few rules. And then there was another change. Storage out on the internet suddenly became available to everyone. And you may not think of it as remote storage, but things like the iCloud and Microsoft's SkyDrive and Google Cloud services, those are free storage sites controlled by individuals, not by a company. And at any given point, you can go to various sites and get gigabytes of free storage. And you can store anything there. Pictures, personal information, even company-related information. And it's under your control, not under the control of the company. So the evolution that happened was gradual and almost unnoticed. And that is that where the company controlled all of its data and the storage of that data and the use of that data and had the ability to back up that data and manage it, suddenly data was in a more of a gray area. It wasn't in the company's own machines and technology base, but it might be in yours or Chris's or mine. And nobody thought about what that might mean for discovery. Similarly, nobody thought about the fact that if I'm working remotely and storing stuff either on one of these cloud services or on a synchronization memo service like Evernote, what could that possibly mean when that information became relevant in a civil action?
So, Chris, what kind of e-discovery implications might this have for an employer's preservation and production obligations if this data is stored on these personal devices and these personal clouds?
Well, as Alan pointed out, when we talk about BYOC and BYOD, we're really just looking at another place that we need to consider when we're looking for potentially discoverable ESI. It's another place that we look at in addition to traditional sources, like exchange servers and shared servers and individual laptops and hard drives. The difference here is that these are places where we store data that are controlled by individuals rather than corporations or by employers. So for a long time, though, we've considered data stored on portable media, like thumb drives or mobile phones, especially for preservation and discovery. The wrinkle is that now, well, really there are two things in this new wrinkle of BYOD or BYOC. The first is an increasing number of these portable devices are owned, and more importantly, I guess, controlled not by a company or an employer or the recipient of a discovery request, but by an employee or by some third party in the case of BYOC. So the balance we have to strike in discovery now under BYOD and BYOC is one between the discovery needs of the litigant, of the person or the company that's received that discovery request, balancing that with the privacy needs of the employee or the third party, whoever that might be, the owner of that BYOD device or the owner of the account in which that BYOC data is stored. So while a company or an employer may have an interest in the data on a BYOD device or in a BYOC cloud environment, that employer may not have control over the device and can't access the device, at least under the Stored Communications Act, without a device owner's informed consent.
So maybe we have, Chris, if you could give us a brief introduction to the Honeybaked Ham case and talk a little bit about what you think the BYOD implications will be. Because if I'm not mistaken, the Honeybaked Ham case talked about another e-discovery challenge, social media.
That's exactly right. Honeybaked Ham is really a BYOC or social media case more than it is strictly a BYOD case. But it is really instructive in a few ways. So by way of background, the EEOC, representing a class of claimants, sued Honeybaked Ham. And in preparing its defense, Honeybaked Ham sought discovery of the claimants, all of those claimants that the EEOC represented. It sought discovery of their social media posts, some of which were related to the case, and some of which were probably, in all likelihood, entirely personal. So the relevant ESI on the social media was, of course, discoverable. But again, looking at that idea of balance, trying to balance the claimant's privacy, so that non-relevant data that they had on these social media sites, like a lot of us have on social media sites, trying to balance their privacy with the need for discovery of relevant data for Honeybaked Ham. So in trying to strike that balance, the court put together a specific protocol for production of all of that data. And that protocol included a few steps. So first, the court ordered each claimant to turn over cell phones used to send or receive text messages and the usernames and passwords that they used to access social media websites and email accounts, blogs, or other sites. So in that sense, I guess, having the claimant surrender their personal devices, this is a BYOD case. But that's pretty much the extent of BYOD in Honeybaked Ham. The real applicable part of Honeybaked Ham, so far as BYOD is concerned, by analogy, is what the court did next. So after all of that data had been collected from the devices and from those social media sources, the court appointed a forensic expert to serve as a special master to review all of that produced ESI in camera. So then after the special master's review of all of that ESI, the court stipulated that it too would conduct an in-camera review. The court would then provide the data that it found relevant to back to the individual claimants or the EEOC so that they could produce or so they could conduct a privileged or a priv review. And following that priv review, then they would produce the relevant ESI to Honeybaked Ham, the requesting party, with a priv log, of course.
So, Alan, if this holding is, could you talk a little bit about why this holding and this opinion in the Honeybaked Ham case was so enlightening for you, especially with regards to BYOD and BYOC best practices?
Well, to be honest, the first thing I thought of when I read the opinion was, they do that spiral slicing. But after I got through that part of it, the thing that struck me, Michelle, was that does it really matter whether information that is a combination of discoverable and not discoverable is on a social media site or on a BYOD device or in a BYOC storage location somewhere on the internet? And I don't think there's a big difference. And I started to think about things like, well, what if there's information on this device and I've also got personal information and medical information and maybe even information on discussions between myself and my personal attorney, and the company suddenly tells me to turn it over and to trust them that they're going to image my machine and they'll be very careful not to look at things that they're not supposed to. Well, I think that there are a lot of folks who would be very unhappy letting people within their company look at that stuff, even to decide that it wasn't relevant and they weren't going to turn it over. And that led me to think about the fact that maybe the decision that the judge had in Honeybaked, which is, why don't we come up with a methodology whereby a third party, a special master or just somebody that everybody agrees on, is going to do the imaging and do the editing, and that nobody within your employer's organization is ever going to see the personal stuff, and that that might be a very reasonable way to get through some of the problems that you can just predict are going to come to pass.
So, Alan, maybe you can bring it all together for us. What are some of the tough cases that you see in the future, and how would an organization like Kroll, the organization that you and Chris, that you work for and that Chris works for as well, Kroll OnTrack, how could organizations like those be involved?
Well, I think the first thing is once you recognize that this kind of a problem potentially exists in a BYOD or BYOC environment, you don't wait for a huge fight with your own people about whether or not you can look at their devices and how you're going to do that, but rather recognize that discovery is likely going to encompass things in a BYOD, BYOC environment and start planning for that now. Have some procedures in place that are going to help you. For example, you may want to have stronger rules about any business-related things being outside the software sandbox that the company sets up within the device that they can remotely copy, monitor, and control. You may also want to have provisions in your agreements with employees that say that in circumstances where it is relevant, we're going to give you a preservation notice, and we're going to require that you provide the machines that are in the BYOD system for imaging, and here's how it's going to be done. And if you don't like that, then, you know, we'll give you another machine, but it's not going to be for your personal stuff. So I think it's really an evolution whereby we go from BYOD being simply this good idea that has taken off really like a rocket. It's amazing how fast BYOD has caught on. And it's got to mature. Like every other piece of technology used in the corporation, we've got to mature and recognize that there are challenges beyond the technology and work with counsel, work with risk managers, work with compliance managers, so that BYOD and BYOC become not a problem child that's just waiting to have a tantrum, but is something we've thought about and is part of our plan, and we're ready to deal with it.
Well, Alan and Chris, thank you for your expertise and your advice and your thoughts on this emerging area, as both of you have pointed out. I thought after that somewhat very serious interview, we should wrap things up by playing a little game, a little walk on the lighter side of e-discovery, so to speak. I'm calling the game the e-discovery time machine. Here's how it works. I'm going to read off a line from a judicial opinion, and I want you two to guess the year. Closest guest wins, and so we're going to use the Price is Right rules, which you want to be the closest to the actual year of the judicial opinion without going over. Are you guys in?
Good for me.
Sounds fun. I'll take BYOD for 100, Alex.
So to start things off, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a hint. All three cases, all three of these quotes, none of them came from this millennium. So keep that in mind. We're talking cases not in this millennium. So here we go with the first quote. It may well be that Judge Charles E. Clark and the framers of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure could not foresee the computer age. However, we now live in an era when much of the data in which our society desires to retain is stored on computer disks. This process will escalate in the years to come, and we suspect that by the year 2000, virtually all data will be stored in some form of computer memory. Any thoughts, either of you, on what year a judge wrote that statement?
I'm going to guess maybe 1980.
Any guesses from you, Chris?
Yeah, I'm going to go, you know, I'm thinking at least they know what computers are, right? And it's entered the court's common parlance. So I'm going to go a little later than that. I'm going to go with maybe 91 or 92.
So Alan hit it right on the nail with his first guess. It was 1980. The case was National Union Electric Corp. Good guess, Alan.
Thank you.
Wow, Alan.
Imagine if I had gone to law school, how much I would know.
So let's take another one. Now, this one comes from a criminal case, so keep that in mind. I spoke with Wayne Thomas, the salesman for Warner, who furnished me with an 8-track tape, which was labeled Jethro Tull Warchild, for $3 cash. Later that day, I met with Mitch Huffman, direct sales manager for Warner, who produced another 8-track tape entitled Jethro Tull Warchild, which he identified as being a genuine tape produced by another subsidiary of Warner Communications. We then played both tapes, and Mr. Huffman and I found that the sounds on the two tapes appeared to be identical. While on the premises, I noticed approximately 500 or more 8-track tapes, which, based on my previous experience in this area, appeared to be unauthorized reproductions of commercial copyrighted tapes. What year were they talking about tape duplication?
Jethro Tull. I have that album. For $3, I can't get that album on iTunes for $3 today. So this has got to be back in the 70s, maybe 74, 73.
Alan, any guess?
I'm just shocked. You mean we don't put 8-tracks in cars anymore? My Corvair has one. Oh, well. I'm thinking before that. I'm thinking maybe 72.
The winner of this one is Chris. He's the closest without going over. 1977. That was U.S. versus Klein out of Massachusetts. All right, one more. One more, and a little bit more related to our topic today. Morris began work on a computer program, later known as the Internet Worm or Virus. The goal of this program was to demonstrate the inadequacies of current security measures on computer networks by exploiting the security defects that Morris had discovered. The tactic he selected was to release a worm into computer networks. Morris designed the program to spread across a national network of computers after being inserted at one computer location on the network. Morris released the worm into the Internet, which is a group of national networks that connect university, governmental, and military computers around the country. The network permits communication and transfer of information between computers on the network. What case, again, a criminal case, talking about the internet? What year?
Well, they mentioned, I think, worms in there. My recollection is that would have been, I'm going to guess, 89? Yeah, I'll go with 1989. Final answer.
1989? Good. Chris, any guesses from you?
The internet. And I'm also, you say it's capitalized, right?
That's right. The entire thing, every single letter capitalized.
I don't know. I'm going to go with maybe 91?
91, right on the money. You and Alan are experts at this game. 1991, that was a case out of New York, U.S. versus Morris. Thanks, you guys.
A lot of fun. Yeah. Thanks, Michelle.
It was great. It was a great little trip down memory lane.
No problem.
And I'm thinking that maybe there's some value in my 8-track.
I think so. Hold on to those. Hold on to
I
those.
I will.
Chris and Alan, thank you for enlightening us all on this very interesting topic. And thank you for joining us here on the ESI Report today.
It's been fun. Thanks.
Always a pleasure, Michelle.
Well, that's a wrap of another ESI Report. Thank you to everyone listening. And thanks again to Kroll OnTrack for sponsoring the show with the Legal Talk Network. As always, don't forget to check out the Kroll OnTrack blog at theediscoveryblog.com. That's www.theediscoveryblog.com. And don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Michelle C.S. Lang. Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, signing off for the ESI Report, your source for e-discovery news and analysis.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll OnTrack. Be sure to follow Kroll OnTrack on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll OnTrack software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for her next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.